Thank you very much, Lars. First of all, I would like to thank you and all the staff of the KITP for having such a splendid organization and location and making all this possible. So you told me that my main task of today is to teach a bunch of accomplished athletes. Right? Now, that is not an easy task. I do not need any interference from smarty pants from the Spintronics program because they think they can do it better than I. Okay. I think a few of the elder ones in the program, I wonder if you sometimes wake up at night desperately realizing that your best time is over and you will never get the Nobel Prize. Right? Now then I have good news for you. Because the ideas I'm telling you today came from two grandfathers far in the 60s, and their ideas is going to revolutionize microelectronics as we know it today. They got already the Oliver Buckley Prize, it's the highest prize for APS, for condensed matter physics. I think they're very strong candidates for the Kavli Prize, and if they live long enough, they are now already far in the 80s, I think that would be suitable for the Nobel Prize as well. Okay, motivation. As you might know that computer and communication industry is going to be in the near future a larger polluter than automobile industry. These power the servers and everything costs enormous amount of energy, enormous amount of heat is dissipated. Iceland, for example, is trying to get not only aluminum smelters, but also global servers, because in Iceland, energy is very cheap, and of course it's nice and cold, the cooling is also not a problem. But clearly this is not a sustainable solution. So we need something else. Microelectronics based on silicon will not help. You can further miniaturize it, but the problem with dissipation is only to increase. And here comes Spintronics with the killer application I was mentioning, which is a real solution to these problems, which might help us to go on for the next 10 years or so. Good. Now, this is my talk. As promised, I will start with classical mechanics, with the scourge of freshman physicists, angular momentum, and related things. Most of spintronics is actually semi-classical, but at sharp interfaces between different materials, we really cannot neglect quantum mechanics. So I think I will have to discuss this as well. My apologies. Essential for spintronics is a material class called ferromagnets. And I would like to try to explain what it is and why it exists. Finally, I would come to real devices and like to explain how they work. If there's time enough, we can discuss topics related to spin transfer, which still have to be researched. Okay, now let's start with just normal mechanics. So assume that we have a couple of particles, right? And they having a certain position and momentum, let's call Ri. Now, the vague concept that something is rotating can be quantified by the angular momentum. Let's have a look before I make any mistakes. Right. So, the angular momentum of such a bunch of particles is called L. It's the sum over these particles, and it is the cross product of position and momentum. So I hope you remember that. Now, it is often useful, especially if you have certain conglomerates which rotate, like in a planetary system, so something like that, to separate angular momentum into one which belongs to the center of mass and the other one. So in that case, we can write this one here as R cross P plus sigma I, which we call R I prime cross P I prime. But this is now measured in the center of mass of our particle system. Now, in this case, we then get two angular momenta. One is these associated to that one, and then one which is associated to this motion. So this we can write as an L of the orbital motion plus this internal angular momentum, and that we can call the spin with the vector S. Now, these two are not always independent. If you throw a curve ball or you bend it like Beckham, you actually calculate mixing the spin with the orbit. And of course, much this is very interesting, but pretty complicated. But today I have not much time for the orbital angular momentum. We are only talking about spin. Good. Now we can have something like that. Now let's talk about momentum transfer. And again, let's look at very simple systems. For example, let's assume we have a particle here, particle 1 and particle 2. If this one has a momentum P, and this would be the situation before the collision of these two at t larger than 0, at t smaller than 0. The collision is at t equals 0, and at t larger than 0, the situation will be, assuming that these two are elastic bodies with the same mass, that we have the particle 1 is here, and the particle 2 is somewhere here, and moving momentum P. This is linear momentum transfer. We have transferred the linear momentum from one particle to the other. Now, how about angular momentum? Let's again this particle P, right, which we now assume also has an angular momentum, like that, so it is rotating. On the second particle at rest at t smaller 0. Now, what happens now at t larger 0? Now, that is actually not so easy, and it depends on the microscopic details. For example, if we lubricate these two, so there is no friction between the two, then the end position will be particle 1 here, particle 1, 2 with P. But clearly, the angular momentum will still be in this particle. The opposite limit is if the grip, the friction between these two balls is very effective, then we can indeed have something like T equals 0. So we have particle 1 here, particle 1 there, and this one is now rotating. This would be an example of classical angular momentum transfer, of spin transfer of the angular momentum from one particle to the other. Now, this is, of course, an extremely simple example. If someone of you has experience with the fine sport of billiards, especially French billiards, they will know that this spin transfer is very complicated. It's a spin transfer not only between the balls, but actually mainly with the boundaries. And it's always coupled also with the spin-orbit interaction, as mentioned here. What the lesson here is basically that spin transfer is not something universal, right? It really depends on what system you have. And that is basically the same in quantum mechanics as well. Now, next question is, what happens if we apply a magnetic field? So assume that we have now, let's take another color, have a magnetic field, and apply this to our system, which has this angular momentum. Now, nothing will happen if these particles are neutral. But let's assume that all these particles are now charged. And the whole thing is moving. Right? So clearly, we know Maxwell's equation, or Ampere's law, says that moving charges generate magnetic fields. Now, to calculate these magnetic fields is, in detail, can be a complicated problem. But if you measure the field outside this distribution, you can make a multipole expansion. And the leading term is the magnetic dipole, or the magnetic moment. Now, the magnetic moment looks quite simple. It is M. It's called M. It's 1/2 sigma. Let's assume that it's charge qi, mass mi, ri cross pi. So we see that it is very similar to the angular momentum. And if we assume that the masses and the charges are the same, and let's assume it's electrons, then we can simply write that this one here is minus e divided by 2m and times l. Now, this one here is this L is the so-called gyromagnetic ratio, the ratio between angular momentum and magnetic momentum. Now, this dipole thus generates magnetic fields, and these magnetic fields can add up to the external one, which increases the energy, or subtract them, which decreases the energy. So the energy can be written as a function, basically, of this angle here. And this energy is equals minus m in product mb. Now, this is the Zeeman energy. The energy of this magnetic moment is minimum if it is parallel to the magnetic field. Maximum, it's antiparallel. Now, we can calculate also the equations of motion of the system. So let's first look at linear momentum of the system, the total system. And that would be p dot equals f. I think you recognize that one, right? It's slow. But I am now writing it in a fancy way, namely as the Poisson bracket with the total energy. Now, your homework assignment for today is to work this out, right? I give you the solution. It is now, if the magnetic field is homogeneous, the magnetic moment does not move, right? Because the gradient is zero. But what we are more interested is in the time dependence of the moment itself, right? Of the spin, this s, right? And this time dependence, if a magnetic moment changes, then this is done not by a force, but by a so-called torque, T-O-R-Q-E. We can calculate this torque exactly in the same way by calculating the Poisson bracket. And again, it's a nice exercise. This is m cross b. Now we can rewrite this in an equation for m. And this is minus gamma m cross b. This is the celebrated Landau-Lifshitz equation for the dynamics of a magnetic moment in a magnetic field. Interestingly, the same equation also holds in quantum mechanics. So that's a very useful one. What does it mean? OK, so here we had the this was our S, right? This is M. Let's call it now M. And M is in the opposite direction, but okay. This was B. So this S or M is now rotating with the, you can do this with the right hand rule, right? You can say B from M points out of the plane. It means it carries out a motion like that. It's a precessional motion around the magnetic field. So this is the basic equations of motion which we need. Right, now, that was already everything we needed from classical mechanics. So, let's go to quantum mechanics. So, what we need here is the work by Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Pauli. Actually, we also would need Dirac, but actually, I think I decide Dirac is a little bit too difficult for this audience, so I think we skip this one. Okay, so we know from Schrödinger that there is a special function.
What yes? About the damping of this motion?
I said no smarty pens, right? You make life really complicated. Yes, in principle, there's also damping.
Can't you just have some kind of argument just at the classical level for the damping?
Sure, so? But I have no time.
No, I just don't.
Okay. Right, there is always damping. There's friction in classical mechanics. There's also, there's no friction for a single quantum spin. But if you have the many particle system, like the magnets, and this dynamics is also damped. Now, this Gilbert damping is still an interesting topic, but we cannot discuss everything, right? Good. Back to the basics, Schrödinger equation. Or first, the wave function. The wave function is a function of, say, all the coordinates of an n-particle system like that. And it contains all the information you would ever like to have from the system, which is described by this thing. Now, this wave function is a solution of the Schrödinger equation, right? And this is basically a wave equation. And for simple solids, it can be calculated quite accurately by computers. So for most solids, we can really solve this, except for the strongly correlated ones. Once we have this wave function, we would like to do something with it. The wave function itself does not have a physical interpretation, but we know that the square of this wave function is a probability distribution to find all the particles in these coordinates. Given the wave function, we can also calculate observables, like O, once we know the operator for this observable. If we know this operator, we can calculate this expectation value as, in this way.
You meant to write square.
Oh, yes, sorry. You're right. Now. That is not all. I think there are several concepts in quantum mechanics which are not so easy. One of them is the uncertainty. So uncertainty can be written like that, and it is simply defined as so that means we do have uncertainties, there are fluctuations around this expectation. We can know something about this uncertainty thanks to Heisenberg. Heisenberg showed that if you have two operators, then the product of their uncertainties equals, or is larger than, half expectation value now, or O P minus P of And this one is the so-called commutator of the operator. What does it mean? If we take, for example, position operator x and y, now we know that this one here commutes with each other, so this is 0. So delta x delta y is some, can be 0 basically. That means if you determine delta x, you can still make delta y in principle arbitrary small. You can measure all coordinates in basically an exact way if you want to do that. However, there are also operators which do not commute. And the most important one is the one with position and momentum. Now this turns out to be h. So we have delta x. Delta dx is larger than h2. So that means if we determine delta x precisely, we don't know anything about dx. These two are correct. So we need this equation soon. I should add here that h bar is, of course, Planck's constant divided by 2. And this is in units of in units of angular momentum. Okay, now let's come to the spin. So it turns out that the electron indeed has angular momentum, and that was first conjectured by Pauli. Since the electron seems to be a real point mass, it's really very difficult to have this in a sort of classic picture for that. But fortunately, it turns out to be a natural consequence of the Dirac equation in the non-relativistic limit. So everything about spin is a consequence of Dirac's equation, and I think at that point we just have to be. Now, what are the properties of the spin? First of all, they have the commutation relations of angular momentum. Let's call it the operator for the spin. So, so the spin is, of course, it's a vector, right? So it has a certain length. The commutation relations are Sx, Sy equals ih, Sz. So that means we cannot really separately measure the angular momentum components. We know that the S, we know also that S squared, Sz, this equals 0. So that means we can determine the length of this vector and the projection in a certain quantization coordinate system, quantization axis Sz. Now, we can determine this. We know that S, the length of this vector, is we also know that Sz comes only in two flavors. This is either plus or minus h divided by 2. So the angular momentum is extremely quantized. There are only two spin states, the up spin state and the down spin state. So, how can we, you would still like to have some sort of a picture of that. We can do it like that. X, Y, Z. So we can still assume that our electron is a soccer ball, right? Which is charged and has angular momentum. We know that the Z component is either plus H bar or minus H bar. But we do not know the X or Y component. But we know the length. So the usual picture is then that this electron spin is precessing at a constant angle here with one constant SC. But we have no idea where it exactly is in this plane. Now the down spin is exactly pointing to the other side, is also precessing with the Z component minus H bar divided by 2 as a constant. Now, this is the angular momentum. We are, of course, mainly interested in the magnetic momentum. Now, there is another surprise, because the magnetic momentum equals and this GE is very close to 2 in most materials. So, classically, we saw that we did not have this GE, but GE is 2. Classically, we could interpret this by assuming that the mass distribution is homogeneous, but the charge is just at the surface of the electron. And you would also get a gyromagnetic factor, which is twice the normal one. But again, this is not really something which carries much weight. And fortunately, the Dirac equation also automatically gives this this G factor. So indeed, we know that also this is now GE times S. And we know this factor quite well. OK, so now we know everything about the electron. The next thing we would like to discuss are many particle systems. And condensed matter is a many particle system. And specifically, I would like now to address, yes?
I have a question.
Yes?
I was wondering if the z direction there is special in some way or not. Is it maybe aligned to the magnetic field? Or?
Yes, in principle, you are free to choose the z direction. And usually, if you choose it in the quantization direction, you get the simple picture. This does not work always. Sometimes we have in one system different spin directions. And then we have to rotate. And this will be, I will discuss this a little bit later. OK, now. OK, now let's go to the many-particle system. And to make it not too difficult, just take two particles. Then we have wave functions. And we now take into account the spin, right? So we have R1, sigma 1, R2, sigma 2. Now the probability distribution to find this P is, again, psi squared, right? Now we're getting Pauli again, because Pauli said that elementary particles like the electron are indistinguishable. That means it is impossible, in principle, to put a label to an electron and say, this is electron 1 and this is electron 2. This means that the probability R1 sigma 1, R2 sigma 2 equals psi. And now the opposite, we exchange the two. Right? OK, so we can solve this equation by saying, OK, psi R1 sigma 1 R2 sigma 2 equals a phase factor psi R2 sigma 2 R1 sigma 1. Now, there's no way how to calculate the phase factor. But we can sort of take a phase factor and see, compare with experiments. It turns out that in elementary particles, all these phase factors have to be either plus 1 or minus 1. The plus ones are the bosons. The minus ones are fermions. We are interested in electrons, so we take the minuses. Now, what happens if we let this particle, R2 sigma 2, approach particle number 1 with the same spin. Then the wave function, this one wave function, but on the same argument, should be that one. And this is only possible if the wave function is 0. Right? So, you know, very general now, R sigma equals 0. Now let's make a little picture out of that. Well, we plot here P. And let's assume that we have electron 1 here at the origin. And this one here is R2 minus R1. And now let's assume that we are if the electron, second electron here is at a certain distance, let's see, it's 1, and we come close to it, the wave function has go to 0 here, figure away, something like that. Right? The probability that this is exactly here is 0. However, if we have a different electron, doesn't make any difference at far distances, but these do not, it's on a different state. So that can be distinguished just by their spin. So this is the opposite spin. Here the distribution function looks like that. It's usually also a little bit suppressed here because there are still the Coulomb interaction, but we neglect this at the moment. Right. Now this is essential in order to understand ferromagnetism.
It's not clear to me what you've just done.
Pardon me?
But I don't know what you've just done. Okay. Because I don't know what the significance of the green line is.
Okay, so we know that if R sigma is exactly in the same place, it has to be 0. However, we can also write psi R sigma R minus sigma. Right, so this wave function here does not, in any way, there's nothing we can say about this by just this relation. There's no reason, they are sort of, because the spin is opposite, they become distinguished. And they are not confined by this principle. So if an electron downspin can go quite close to the upspin, only the upspin electron is really has the so-called exchange hole around it. Other electrons cannot come close. Okay, now ferromagnetism. Ferromagnetism is a many particle state in which all the spins, or a large part of them, points in one direction. So it is a state with a broken time reversal symmetry. And the question is, why does it exist? Let's make a very simple argument on what the conditions are. And to do that, we start with the so-called, already with the ferromagnetic state. So let us assume that we have a system of electrons which pointing all in the same direction. In order to find out whether this is stable or not, we can add an additional electron either in the upspin state or in the downspin state. If we add an electron in the upspin state and the total energy goes down, then we know that this polarized state is a stable one. Right? Now, what happens if we add an electron in the upspin state? If we put it just sort of at this point here, right, put this new electron here, then, because of this exchange principle, all the other electrons have to be automatically at a larger distance. Right. So this additional electron now creates this exchange hole around. So without doing anything to the wave functions, all the other electrons are now at a distance. And this has consequences for the energy. There is, for example, the Coulomb energy. Right? If the electrons come close, it costs you a lot of Coulomb energy, and this energy is E squared divided by the distance. Now, what's the distance? Now, I have to specify now what the electron gases we're having here. We can characterize this by a density, and the density is usually measured in the average distance between the electrons, the so-called RS. A large RS would be a low density. We can also characterize such an electron gas in the condensed matter by an effective mass, and let's call this M star. In the condensed matter, the mass of the electrons does not have to be the bare electron mass. It is modified by interaction with the lattice. Okay, so by having all the electrons now separated, we know that there is a we win Coulomb energy, which is of the order of E squared, of this average distance, which the other electrons go away. There is some constant we are not interested in, that is negative. Now this energy is called the exchange energy. So this, we gain energy. And we also have to pay energy, because by putting this electron in the exchange hole, we are localizing. Now we have seen that the uncertainty in the momentum is related to, what was it, h bar divided by 2 times delta x. That would be one dimension. Now if we are putting the electrons in this hole here, we are localizing it on the scale of this RS. So the electron does not like to be confined, it starts to wiggle. And this wiggling costs kinetic energy. So the kinetic energy cost is now delta kinetic. But we know that is simply d squared divided by 2 m star, and this is the effective mass, right? Now, we can simply fill in this uncertainty and we get some uninteresting constant C2 times h bar divided by 2m times 1 divided by 1 s squared. So whether or not we get a ferromagnet or whether or not this polarized electron gas is stable depends on the balance of these two numbers. Now, if you compare that you do get ferromagnetism if m star times s is larger than some constant c. So if you take a normal electron gas and make it more dilute, at some point it will become ferromagnetic. If you put in the real electron mass here, then this density would be extremely dilute and you would not find it in conventional condensed matter. We do get ferromagnet in real materials by the fact that this effective mass can be large. And one of the materials where this effective mass is large are the transition metals, especially cobalt, iron, and nickel. Now, these numbers here are actually huge. So that means the difference between these numbers can also be large. That means in some material, ferromagnetism is really a very stable state. For example, against thermal perturbations. And we know that from the Curie temperature of cobalt, which is 1400 Kelvin. And that's close to the melting temperature. So crystallization energy and exchange energy can be of the same order of magnitude. And this is, I think, the technological success of spintronics is based on that. Because many of these applications just work at room temperature. Good. Now, that was the basics, and now let's go to devices.
This is the expression for the kinetic energy.
Yes.
That's the first time we've seen capital M star, is that right?
Yes. So capital M star is really something you have only in condensed matter. Because in condensed matter, the electrons move in a periodic potential. And we know, so I cannot go in detail, from band theory that this modifies the masses.
In different ways and different materials.
Different materials, right. And in transition metals, you have these d electrons, which are pretty localized. And they cannot hop easily from one place to the other, which is equivalent to a large effective mass. And this gives you the fact. How I'm doing time. Right. Okay, so a real device, so it's actually the workhorse of spintronics, is called a spin valve. Let's discuss that. Spin mop is made from metals. Now, metals is basically a big bucket. And you can fill it up with electrons like you fill up the bucket with water up to a certain level, which we call the Fermi limit. Right. Now we have a ferromagnet. That means we actually have two buckets, those for the spin-up state and those for the spin-down state. So here we have a second bucket, which is, now this is the up spin, this is the down spin. And we see now we have a difference in these two. This difference here is the exchange potential delta. Now, in order to keep things simple, we will assume that delta is larger than EF. That means that this bucket here is actually empty. Now, these metals exist. They are so-called half metals. There's only one spin which can live in these. Now, let's take this half metal and put it next to a normal metal, right? So here we have an interface, and here we have a normal metal. Let's also assume, one other thing. What we can do by applying a voltage to such a metal is to shift such a bucket up and down relative to others. So let's assume we also have a voltage applied, and the energy is EV. Okay, now put it next. So this is a ferromagnet, and here we have a normal metal. But normal metal is now also consists actually of two buckets, right? Two buckets which are filled to the Fermi energy. Now, exactly in the same way, it's a normal metal. We have the same up and down. This could be copper. Okay, now, let's make a spin valve. It consists of three layers, two ferromagnets and normal metal in between. And let's assume that here also we have some voltage applied. So this bucket goes down here, and the Fermi energy would be here. And this is also our spin valve. Now clearly, these upspin electrons, if this one is transparent, that is what we assume, they can spill over into this one here. We have some electrons going into here. Nothing, this one here doesn't do anything, but these electrons here can clearly, you can also put these over each other, so this one is as close to that one as this one. From here, it directly flows through to this one. So this spin valve is conducting. Now let's assume that we can change the magnetization of this one here into the opposite. Now, what is happening now? So, these electrons, they can go to that one here, but this one has no way to escape because it cannot live in the spiral. So, this is just going to be filled up. Now these electrons, they can flow into this one here, but only a little bit until this is on the same level here. Right? So we have now, this one is occupied to here, and this one is occupied to here. And after that, nothing is happening. So there are two things. This became, in this way, electrically insulated. Electron cannot, there's no current now, in spite of the voltage we have. Another thing is that, we have now basically magnetized this normal metal, because we see the Fermi energy here is now larger than this Fermi energy. So this normal metal became magnetic. There is a so-called spin accommodation. There's no current. So if we now apply a magnetic field to this system, which points in this direction, we can force this spin also in the opposite direction, and then go from an insulating state to a conducting state. Now, this dependence of the electrical transport properties on applied magnetic fields in these multi-layers is called giant magnetic resistance effect. And that was the Nobel Prize of, what was it, of Fecht and Grünheim. Good. So this is an important device which is being used as a magnetic field sensor in basically all magnetic data storage disks which we have. So we're almost there. Still one difficult thing to discuss, and that is what happens if the magnetization is not up and down, but is pointing in this direction. And this question was already addressed. Now things get really a little bit difficult because we have to understand the rotation of spins. How much time do I have? 10 minutes? Okay, maybe, just. We know we have to live in the space of two states, up spin and down spin. If we want to rotate spin, the only way we can do is we can make linear combinations. So we can create a wave function, which is C spin up state plus C2 spin down state. Or we can write this as C1, 1, 0 plus C2, 0, 1. So what is such a linear combination? We have to find out what is the spin state corresponding to such a combination. And to that, we have to look again back at the definition of the spin operator, S. So S has the units of angular momentum, and it can be written like that, where sigma is the vector. It has to be a 2x2 matrix in the space of these up and down spins. Up and down spins. It's called the Pauli spin vector. So that is written h prime by 2. And then, 0, 1, comma, 0, minus 1, 1, then I, and 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So now let's just take a typical spin state, and let's call it C equals 1 divided by 2, 1, 1. So it's a linear combination of the up and the down spin. Now what we now can do, we can calculate the expectation value psi, S psi. Now this is just a matrix multiplication, where we take here the, let's write it out. This is C H divided by 2. Then we have 1, 1, sigma. And just have a look what comes out of this is H divided by 2. Times 1, 0, 0. So we see here now the point, the spin points in the x direction. The x direction spin is a linear combination of the up and the down spin in the z direction. So this is not easy to understand. It's just one of these things. Okay. Now we know how to rotate the spins, and now we can calculate what happens here at this interface, where we have a right angle between the magnetization and the spin application. Okay, so let's consider this system. This is N, this is F, and we are coming now in with the spin, which is an up spin. and we would like to know what happens to such a spin. Magnetization here is 2 to 1. Now we know that this up spin here is right spin plus left spin. Right? So here only the right spin can survive. That means that this ferromagnetic interface acts as a beam splitter. So we have part of the spin is going through. This is the right spin divided by 2. And part of it is going to 2. And part of it is being deflected. Left spin divided by square root 2. Now what does it mean? For each electron which hits this interface, it will contribute to a current. We're coming in with a charge E. Half of it is transmitted, half of it is reflected. So we have for each scattering process E divided by 2 as a current, right? So J charge equals E divided by 2 per electron. How about the spin? Spin current has a direction on the polarization. So the direction is here the x direction. Right? So Js on the right side of this ferromagnet would be h bar divided by 2 times x and another factor 4. Now this electron, which is reflected here, is a spin current, which is in the other direction. So it is goes in the other direction, so there's a minus. Magnitude is clearly the same. Polarization is opposite, minus x. So these two are the same, which means that we have at this interface a spin current, angular momentum current, parallel to the magnetization, which is continuous. So far, so good. But what happened to the angular momentum which were coming in here? This is absorbed. It is absorbed, and we know that if you don't conserve angular momentum, you have to have a torque. This gives you a torque on the magnetization. It would like to move the magnetization, and the magnitude here is h bar divided by 2. Okay, now. We said that we have a spin accumulation here, which means that we have extra filled states for upspin, but empty states for downspin. We can fill the empty states by letting electrons flow from the ferromagnet to the normal matter. So we will also have scattering processes. An electron comes in here, and it fills here the empty state on the spin down. And this can be done by having here another electron which also points in this direction, divided by 2. In this case, we have a spin current which is longitudinal to the magnetization in the opposite direction with the same magnitude as here. But the angular momentum, the torque here, is spin down is going away, so the torque here also goes in this direction. Now we can combine these two scattering processes such that we are coming in with spin up and going out with spin down. That means we have a spin flip at the interface and the magnetization experience the torque h bar, twice h bar divided by 2. Now this has an effect for the dynamics of the magnetization because we remember we had the Landau-Lifschitz equation, which is min gamma m plus b, but we have now to add to it the torque from the interface, which looks like actually this torque here we have calculated, which is the spin current times gamma minus gamma times delta x at the interface. So what does it mean for the devices? So a real device is a nanopillar. It's really a very small pillar like that. And it consists of two magnets. One is usually a fixed one because it's sort of a big one which cannot be moved easily. That's a normal metal. And there is a thin one like that, which is then connected to the other side. Now what we now can do, well, let's put it first in this direction. Let's assume it's light direction. So if we now drive the current in this direction, we are generating a spin accumulation here, and which gives you a torque in this direction, which means that this magnet would like to go into this state. However, if we reverse the current, then it means that this electron here sucks the upspin electrons out, so the spin accumulation here will be in the opposite direction, and the torque will also be in the opposite direction, in this direction. So in this case, the stable state is the antiparallel combination. If you look at the electrical resistance of such a device as a function of the light current, and you start from a parallel state with low resistance, then at a certain critical current, the resistance will go from parallel to antiparallel in the higher resistance state like that. If you return the current back, you get something which is called hysteresis. In order to switch back, you have to go to the opposite direction, and then the resistance goes like that. And this would be a typical characteristic of such a spin model. So what we have now is a memory element, right? It's a zero if it's parallel. It's a one if it's antiparallel. You can easily read it out by the electric resistance, and you can switch it by current pulses. Now, this has now lots of advantages. It's a so-called non-volatile memory. You switch the voltage off, and it means the memory state is still there. This is the same as a flash memory, right? But that is has many disadvantages. It's slow, and you cannot have no endurability. You can make these memories as dense as the DRAM, which is the typical workhorse in semiconductor industry, and you can make it as fast as SRAM, which are the fast ones for the caches, for example. It scales favorably, and it is reprogrammable, so you can also use it for computing. Now, if you would like to know any more details about technology, there's Dr. Lee. He is connected to Samsung. He can tell you much about what's happening there. And that is basically, that's rest. So I have no time in order to explain things like quantum spin torque and spin pumping. Kaido, I'm sorry, I wanted to draw a windmill, but I
haven't. Well, there's only two talks.
Sorry. Yeah.
Let's hear it before we go to questions.
Thank you very much.
Questions? So what's the largest number of these in the debate? It looks like
a you can buy them from Everspin for 64 megabytes, I think. That's a pretty small one, but it is... This is megabyte, yeah, but it's very fast and much better than flash. But people like Samsung.
How big is it?
What was it, 64 megabyte?
No, physically.
Oh, physically, oh, just a very small chip. So it's there. The size is not such a problem. The density is. But the idea, yes?
What is it? How much energy do you use in such devices?
Yes, that is indeed another good point, right? Because I think you save energy in different ways. First of all, it's non-volatile. So in contrast to DRAM, which is basically a condensator, which has to be charged up regularly, you can just leave it. Only that already saves you a lot of energy. What is still an issue a little bit is the power it needs to switch. I think they have now powers which are really comparable with semiconductor memories, but the reliability is still a little bit an issue. Would you like to comment on that? No? It's a secret, yeah.
So to whom are these potential Nobel Prizes going to go to?
Pardon me? Oh.
You mentioned potential Nobel Prizes.
The Nobel Prize.
Sure.
This is because this is John Slonczewski and Luc Berger. Didn't I mention the name? Oh, I'm sorry. No, that, I should have done that. Okay. These are John. Former IBM and Luc Berger. Let's see, what was this university? What?
Carnegie Mellon.
Carnegie Mellon, yeah. In Pittsburgh.
You mentioned these things are non-volatile. What is the energy barrier for thermal flipping?
Yeah, so that is that the device engineers have a certain rule. I think it should be something like 70 kt, isn't it?
Also around that.
Around that. If so, you can realize that there's actually a trick necessary to do that. You have to take I think materials which are magnetized perpendicular to the plane. So I think it's not easy to do that, but it can.
Great. If you Google Moore's Law and failure, you get a bunch of self-labeled experts giving their prediction on when it will fail, when some say it already has failed.
Yes.
So based on your knowledge here, could you chime in with your opinion?
Yeah, so of course at some point it has to fail, right? I guess exponential growth is definitely non-sustainable. I think my point of view is, and again, I let myself corrected by people with industry connections, is that the main bottleneck is thermodynamic. It really, these transistors in the present, I think they are really getting hot. The energy density, I've been said, is the same as in a rocket nozzle, for example. Mm. So the point is, I think they can still go smaller, but the point is to it's really the energy. And here, I guess, spintronics can help because you can save energy by being non-volatile, so you don't have any leakage problems. And the problem of the switching current, I think, can be solved. And I think in this way, I think you can get continue a few more years. Yes. Thank you.
You discussed only memory. So far, is there a possibility for having something like transistors and more complicated devices?
Yes, definitely. I think it's already been used for logics. So you can make logic circuits out of that. And you can sort of change the logics because this is reprogrammable. And this is definitely one of the ideas which people are following up. Not only memory, but also logics and eventually even computing. Yes.
Great. Thanks, Gary.